Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Noach. The Pardes Executive Learning Seminar is coming up. That will be December 18th through 22nd in Jerusalem. The theme this year is Ruth and Esther, From Rags to Royalty. The master schedule and full information is available on the Pardes website. I urge you to check it out. There will be a new executive learning seminar also in Jerusalem on July 2nd through 6th. But the December one, that's December 18th through 22nd, is selling out quickly, and the registration deadline is the end of November. So please check out the information and join us here in Jerusalem for the seminar. This week, Noach with Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Noach. In previous podcasts, we have examined the story of the flood. We have spoken about the corruption of the generation of the flood. We have looked into the significance of the ark as forming the womb, the fetus of the new world that is to be created. Today I would like to examine chapter 10 to see how this new world developed. And I'll begin by saying that if I had to give it a title, I would say On Nations and Power. So let me begin with the idea of, which I think is the central point of this chapter, how nations developed in the aftermath of the flood. The chapter begins by saying, Ve'ele todot bnei Noach, these are the progeny of the sons of Noach. And then it speaks about Shem, Cham, and Yefet, who are the sons of Noach, and how sons were born to them after the flood. And then it goes on to list for each of the sons a whole slew of children, and to be honest, boys, who were born to them. And the significance of the lists which we are given in this chapter is because everyone who is mentioned becomes a nation. There is a very interesting rabbinic phrase which comes up quite a bit, the 70 nations of the world. The number 70 is derived from this chapter. Because if I actually go through the various sons of Noah and tally up the different children, we will find that Yefet has 14 sons who are mentioned, Cham 30, Shem 26, which add up to 70. How do these nations develop? The best way to see this is maybe in verse 20. When it talks about the sons of Cham, it summarizes, right, that section. It says, these are the sons of Cham, lemishpechotam, lilshonotam, ba'artzotam, begoyehem. The sons of Cham, according to their families, their language, their land, in their nations. What are the building blocks of a nation? According to this, three components: family, language, land. I would say that this is what could be called the most organic, the most natural way in which a nation develops. What do I mean by that? You start off with what we could call the core family. That core family multiplies. It becomes an extended family. We all know that families have their own language. They have their own way of communicating with each other. In fact, we know that, in other words, the more intimate people are, words, right, mean something very special to them, which means something very different for others. So they develop what we could call a language of their own. And the next element is the land, which means that the family on the one hand is concentrated in a certain area, but I would like to say that the area where they find themselves also impacts on them. It impacts on their language. It impacts on their way of looking at the world. It impacts on their culture. And if we look at each of these different peoples, each of them were in a different area. And by being in a different area, they created a different type of nation. And here perhaps it's appropriate to say that the word that's used for nation is goy, as opposed to another word, which we're very familiar with, which is am. What is the difference between am and goy? Am refers to a mass of people. A mass of people who do not necessarily have a shared value system. Perhaps the only thing which they share is that they are just a lot, and I would probably say concentrated, in a certain area. In modern Hebrew, there's a slang word, amcha. Amcha, which refers to the masses, the hoi polloi. But goy is different. For those of you who are familiar with the Haggadah, at one point in the Haggadah, it says, the Jewish people went down to Egypt, vayihi sham legoy gadol, they became a big goy. And in the Haggadah, there is this exposition, this drash, melamed shayu mitzuyanim sham. This teaches us that they, now I could translate this as they excelled there. Mitzuyan in modern Hebrew means to excel. But I think a better translation of the word mitzuyanim is that they distinguished themselves. And perhaps distinguished themselves in the sense of being separate, having a unique identity. So that the idea of a goy is not just that you're a group of people who happen to be living in a certain area, but there's something which you have which is unique, which is distinct, which is separate from everyone else. And what I would say is, which also distinguishes you from everyone else. It is very interesting that very often, peoples are very much a function of the land where they find themselves, of the resources which are there, of the climate which shapes the personalities. In today's world, we think of the Gulf states, and we immediately associate that with oil. We think of other places that are very rich in natural resources. And I would even add, different areas have different resources, and as a result, shape people differently. But in theory, this can actually be something which is very, very positive, which is very, very healthy. Because what it means is, when I look at the world, this can become this model of pluralism, of being able to see how each group has its own ethnicity, has its own uniqueness, has its own, I would say, richness, each one complementing the other. And together it forms a mosaic of what we would call the world, which can just strengthen every single element. In another podcast, I spoke about the creation story, chapter 1 of Genesis, and said that one of the aspects of creation, which was very, very significant, was the idea of each in the creation of the vegetation, in the creation of the animals, in the creation of the birds and the fish, how each thing is created according to its species. The idea being that each species is individuated. And by having a multiplicity of species, it creates a world which is very, very beautiful. The beauty is in the merging of all of the unique different elements. That concept of Leminehu breaks down and reaches a certain low point in the generation of the flood. We're told in the beginning of the parsha that the world is filled with chamas, with violence. We're told about the fact ki hishchit kol basar et darko, that all flesh had corrupted its ways. And the rabbis comment how there was no separation between people and animals, how people were copulating with animals, how people were crossbreeding, and in that process, destroying all of the unique aspects of each element of creation. So that one could see that what's happening in chapter 10 is a corrective, is trying to now create that sense of liminehu among the peoples of the world. Perhaps I should point out that in chapter 6, in last week's parsha, it is very interesting how the chapter begins by saying, and when men began increasing on the face of the earth. And one could say that what's happening there is the fulfillment of the divine command of be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And they're finally doing it. The rabbis understand that the word hechel has the element chol or chilul, which means there's a desecration. That this new beginning might actually be, in a certain sense, a desecration. Yes, on the one hand, we're filling the earth, but on the other hand, maybe we're desecrating it. And what's interesting is what then comes up is the sons of God are looking at the daughters of man, that they are tovot, and they take to them wives from all that they choose, which on a certain level seems to be positive, because what it's saying is that there is this kind of intermingling. We're doing away with what could be called maybe class distinctions. There are certain commentaries who want to say that the sons of God are the aristocracy, the elite, the judges. The daughters of man are the commoners. And all of a sudden, we don't have these social classes. We're breaking down that element, which is very, very positive. And yet one could see that, yes, it looks positive, but maybe, in fact, it's actually not so positive. And in fact, we're told in the continuation that God is very, very upset with what is going on in the world. In verse 5, it says that God sees that evil is proliferating on the earth, and all the thoughts of people's hearts are only evil, which means that maybe there are certain things that look positive, but in fact may actually be very, very negative. So that what ostensibly seems to be a positive element of somehow breaking down the barriers, just having everyone mixed together, may actually not be so positive. I want to use that chapter as the basis for something which comes up in our chapter, in chapter 10, which is exceptional. And what do I mean by that? Chapter 10 is basically a listing of all the sons who, as I said, eventually become nations. But there is one exception. In the midst of this list, there is one son who we elaborate upon, and that is chapter 10, verse 8, Nimrod. We spend a number of verses talking about this individual Nimrod, which in a certain way is an anomaly in this section. And I would like to now focus on this personality, Nimrod. And perhaps the first thing which I would like to say, which appears in a commentary, Kasuto, who was a professor in the Hebrew University in the 1900s, who says that Nimrod is an individual, not a nation. And in that sense, all of a sudden there's some, what I would call, foreign element which is being inserted in this section. And maybe let me highlight this by saying, in the middle of a section, which is basically focusing on the formation of nations, and what I would even call the organic formation of nations, family, language, land, nation, all of a sudden we're told the story of Nimrod. Who is Nimrod? Note, it says in verse 8, Hu hechel liyot gibor ba'aretz. So the first thing which I would like to point out is he began, the same word that's used in chapter 6. And remember I said to you that the word hechel could mean begin, but it might also have the connotation of a beginning, which is a desecration. And what did he begin to do? To be a mighty man in the land. Interestingly, in chapter 6, later on when it talks about the evil of the land, just before that, in verse 4, it says, "It was at that time that there were the Nephilim who were on the earth, and afterwards as well, when the sons of God came upon the daughters of man and bore to them, they were the Giborim, the heroes of old. They were Anshei Hashem, the men of distinction, the men with a name," which means the first time that the idea of Giborim comes up is actually in chapter 6. And immediately after that, it speaks about how evil is proliferating in the land. What is a Gibor? Gibor are mighty men. Gibor are heroes. We know in classic literature, in mythologies, who are the heroes? Who are the Giborim? The men of prowess, the men of strength. If we were actually look through the Tanakh, generally when we use the word Gibor, it's associated with warfare, my ability to triumph, but I would say even more to display my power. One might say that in chapter 6, the word Gibor perhaps goes hand in hand with Hamas. Hamas, which is violence. My power is reflected by my ability to overcome, to exploit. One might even say to destroy those that are weaker than me. Let us go back to Nimrod. Nimrod is described as someone who is beginning to be a Gibor Ba'aretz. I would like to suggest, in the middle of this new world which is forming, which I would say is forming in a very, very positive way, Nimrod is beginning to bring into that world elements of the previous world that was destroyed. What is his power? In verse 9 it says, he was a Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem. His power is associated with hunting. And almost all the commentaries say his power is reflected in his mastery over the animals. And by the way, this is a motif which appears again in ancient literature. Who are the heroes? The heroes are the ones who are able to defeat the wild animals, the monsters, the beasts, the mythic creatures. If we go back to chapter 9, when Noah and his sons come off the ark, God says in chapter 9 that your fear will be upon all the animals of the earth. They will be handed over to you. This is chapter 9, verse 2. But what seems to be over there, and the word that's used is chitchem, your dread. In this new world which is created, there seems to be this tension, this hostility between the people and the animals, and that somehow people need to assert their dominion and perhaps assert it through fear, or in the case of Nimrod, through cunning, to use that cunning to trap the animals, to ultimately kill those animals. But commentaries also say that Nimrod's gvura, his power, that he demonstrates over the animals, then empowers him over people. The verse which I just quoted is very interesting because it lends itself to very different explanations. It says, Nimrod was a Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, before God. The classic medieval commentary, the Ibn Ezra, says, what does it mean he was a hunter before God? He says that Nimrod would hunt animals, kill them, then offer them up on altars to God. And he says, this is the pshat. And taken at face value, that would be actually emphasizing Nimrod's religiosity. And then Nimrod would become an extremely significant figure in terms of, one might even say, a corrective to what was in the generation of the flood. Because in the flood, it seems that the Nephilim, the Giborim, were at odds with God, were associated with evil. Here is Nimrod, who ostensibly is taking all of that power and channeling it towards worship of God. But quite a few commentaries, and certainly in the Midrash, Midrashic literature, see that the same cunning which Nimrod exercised in defeating his animals, he uses in hunting people. His religiosity is a facade. It is a way of trapping people, not to worship God, but ultimately to get them to worship him. There are commentaries who want to say that when it emphasizes that Nimrod is a Gibor Tzad Lifnei Hashem, that doesn't mean that he was doing whatever he was doing to God. It's just a way of ascribing to someone who is a hunter superhuman, divine qualities. He is somebody who's right up there with God. Now, obviously, the Ibn Ezra says, well, but that's not the simple reading of the text, because Nimrod would seem to be, as I said, a positive figure, according to the Ibn Ezra. But then we come to the next verse, verse 10. It says, and the beginning of his kingdom was in Bavel, and Erech, Akkad, Chalnei, in the land of Shinar. And then from that land, he went to Ashur, and he built Nineveh, etc., etc. Interestingly, the Torah does not explicitly state that Nimrod was a king, but it does speak about his kingdom. And maybe this is also something which is very, very subtle. Nimrod did not declare himself to be a king, but engaged in a project of creating a kingdom where de facto he would be the king. Where is this happening? Well, this is happening in Bavel, in Erech, Akkad, Chalnei, what we know as Mesopotamia. But in fact, that area of Mesopotamia should have been the area of the descendants of Shem. Nimrod is a descendant of Cush. Who are the children of Cush? Mitzrayim, Canaan. Essentially, the descendants of Cush are the inhabitants of Africa, of what today is Saudi Arabia, of Canaan. Nimrod basically has, in a certain sense, usurped someone else's territory. I didn't mention this before, but if we look at the different sons of Noah, Yefet basically is what today we would call Europe, Asia Minor. Shem, Mesopotamia. Ham, Africa. Saudi Arabia. Here is Nimrod, who is now going to an area which is not organic, which is far from where his forebears went. Now let me add, in a story which came just before chapter 10, Noah curses his son, Ham. Noah says that his son, Canaan, will be an Eved Avadim, will be a slave, servant of servants to his brother. In a way, Nimrod is from that group of people who Noah said will be servants. And his response is to perhaps become the first king and to establish, right, a bridgehead in the land of Bavel, in the land of Shinar. In chapter 11, we were told of the story of the Tower of Babel. Where is this story unfolding? In the land of Shinar. Who is the driving force behind the story? It seems to be a grassroots movement of a people who are gathering together. In many ways, it seems to be the opposite of the description in chapter 10. Whereas in chapter 10, we speak about diversity. We speak about spreading out, each group being somehow unique in its language, unique in its nationhood. All of a sudden, this seems to be an expression of universalism. We have one language. We will be in one place. There is a sense of brotherhood. I would just like to point out two things from this story. The first is the word that's used for language. It's not Lashon, it's Safa. The Hebrew language is beautiful. Lashon has to do with the tongue. Safa is language that has to do with lips. And we know that, in fact, language is formed. There are guttural sounds. There are sounds that are formed by the lips. What differentiates the lips from the tongue? The lips are external. The tongue is internal. And I would like to suggest that Lashon, the nations that form with a Lashon, have a language which is very, very deeply rooted, which reflects a very, very deep connection between those who are speaking that language. Safa is something which is external. And here I'll throw in artificial. We create a language, but the language is artificial. We create a sense of brotherhood, but the brotherhood is artificial. If you look at what they're doing, they're saying, let us now make bricks, because the place where we live has no stone. Bricks are artificial, they're man-made. The whole framework which they're trying to create is artificial. Perhaps I will say, it appears as something which is very, very beautiful. We speak about brotherhood, but in reality, it's artificial. There is a very pithy rabbinic comment which says that in the process of building the tower, if a person would fall down to their death, nobody would pay any attention to that. If a brick would fall, people would bemoan the loss of the brick because the brick was instrumental to the project. What is that project? The project is the Naaselanu Shem. Let us make a name for us. I want to now go back to what I spoke about earlier. The rabbis, because of the association with the place, Eretz Shinar, and with what I see in chapter 10, when it talks about Nimrod, where his kingdom is, in the land of Shinar, the rabbis say that Nimrod is the driving force behind this project. The purpose of this project is to make a name. Ostensibly, it's for us, but it might be for Nimrod, for the glory of Nimrod. Or, if I take another rabbinic comment, for the glory of mankind who are in opposition to God. Let me go back to chapter 6. In chapter 6, we talk about the Giborim. We also talk about Anshei Hashem, the men of name. The association between Giborim and having a name. Nimrod is a Gibor, the desire to create a name. Let me perhaps phrase things now a little bit differently. In the midst of this world which is developing, of nations, of diversity, of nations that have unique identities, which can actually be a very, very positive thing. Nimrod is now creating the concept of kingdoms. Kingdoms which are based on power. Kingdoms which are trying to now consolidate, and I would even say to create a certain uniformity. A uniformity which is artificial, which in the end is not really reflecting the deep values that connect us, but perhaps the only thing which connects us, which people rally around, is the hero, Nimrod, is the city, the tower, all of which are reflections of power. And I might add, all of which are perhaps driving God out of this world. Ironically, the Tower of Babel may be doing a very similar thing to what was going on in the generation of the flood, to break down those separations and barriers, and to basically say, we're all one. except that it's being done in a much more sophisticated way, perhaps in a much more cunning way, in a way which is much more deceptive. In response to the Tower of Babel, it says that God scattered them. This is chapter 11, verse 8. God scattered them across the face of the earth. That's different than when people were separated by their own choice, separated in a way that was very, very natural. Here they're just being scattered in a way which is very, very destructive. But that scattering perhaps can become the basis of a rebuilding, a new formation. And this then leads us into what will be next week's parasha, chapter 12, the formation of the Jewish people. And I just want to point out that the formation of the Jewish people, in a way, is at odds with what I described in chapter 10. And what do I mean by that? Abraham, who will be given his mission to form the Jewish people, is told, separate yourself from your family. I would even say separate yourself from your language, your culture. Certainly separate yourself from your land. What is the basis of the Jewish nation? In next week's parsha, enter into a relationship with God. Because that's what the world needs. And the rabbis see Abraham as being, in many ways, the polar opposite of Nimrod. In the same way that Nimrod was an anomaly in chapter 10, Abraham will be an anomaly, but in a radically different way. The driving force behind Nimrod was power. The driving force behind Abraham is service of God. By serving God, by following God, Abraham will merit to have children, to have a family. He will then be given a language, a set of values, a culture which is unique to the Jewish people. And he will then be given also a land in which to play that all out. So that rather than our nationhood being a natural development of family, language, and culture, and land, it is a radical development because everything begins with entering into a relationship with God. This begins the third creation story, which we are still part of. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schreiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.